Joyce Grandjent is one of those people who had both success at work and an addiction to crack. It would eventually cause her to lose her car and her home and contact with family. And while Joyce has it together now, and though she's been clean for 16 years, she still has trouble believing that her new life is her real life.
I remember having dreams where I woke up and I thought I was using. You cannot imagine the relief I felt that it was just a dream and I wasn't back in that dark, desperate, bleak part of my life anymore. I felt immense pleasure and immense relief to know, woo, that was just a dream. I'm not really sitting in a smoke-filled room getting high.
Joyce says the reason those dreams can still scare her is that she now knows just how easy it would be to slide back into the life of a crack addict. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Most often when we talk about the kind of trouble people have with powder cocaine or crack, it's a story that starts with a broken home and young men who drift into gang life and then dealing and smoking. Joyce Grandjent doesn't fit this pattern. Her mother ran a firm home. Joyce went to college, and she just landed a job as the supervisor at an HMO. The trouble for Joyce was that she found that she really wasn't very welcome there.
I was the first African-American black supervisor that was hired to manage a medical record department.
Pressure on you?
Yes, there was immense pressure because the employees, of which I had 38, sort of felt betrayed by the company that they had went outside of the company and brought in a black supervisor. So my second day on the job, a note was put under the administrator's door that said that I was trying to start a race riot.
You were trying to start a race riot?
Yeah. They let it be known in no uncertain terms that they felt betrayed. Why did they bring an outside person in? First of all, when they had competent staff in the department, but more importantly, why did they hire a black supervisor?
Could you do anything to win them over, Joyce?
You know, what I did was I called the staff meeting. My administrator came up. She showed me the letter that was written anonymously. And so what I decided to do was call a staff meeting that very day. And I brought all of the employees together. And I talked about the letter. And I told them I understood how they might feel betrayed. However, that was an administrative decision. And that I was hoping that we could have a really good working relationship, that it really shouldn't matter what color I was as long as we all worked together. I thought that that might work, just addressing the issue head on, but it did not.
So what kind of thing was happening at that office that made it clear to you that you weren't welcome, either as a new supervisor or as a black supervisor?
When I had to go to meetings, the secretary had to answer my phone. So whenever she had to answer my phone, she would wipe the whole receiver down with alcohol. So say I forgot a report and I would come back and I'd pick up the phone, it would be wet and smelling of alcohol. And I would be like, why is my phone smelling of alcohol and it's wet? And I mean, it would be dripping. It's not like, you know.
Did you confront her? Did you say, what are you doing?
Well, she told me that, you know, she didn't want to get any germs.
I bet she didn't wipe down the phones that the other people were using in the office, though.
I doubt very seriously. I went to the washroom, and I remember standing in the stall, and tears was just running down my face because it was just so hurtful, and it was like, why does it matter so much that I am black? And why is that such a problem? And it was something that we didn't seem able to get past. And it even got so that in order to make me look incompetent, the medical record department stayed open 24 hours. So it was my job to make sure that everything ran efficiently and that all of the charts got to the different specialty areas. Well, they would break the machine that would sort of spin out the schedule for each area. So the machine all of a sudden began to break. So, of course, if those charts aren't in the area that they're supposed to be the next day when patients start coming, you can imagine the confusion. It's like the doctor is there, the patient is there, where's the chart?
So are you saying, Joyce, that they were sabotaging this machine so you would look incompetent?
Yes. Yes, they were. And not only did they do that, but they start going in the files and taking out, like we had a monthly calendar, so they knew when I had different meetings, whether it was quality assurance. So all of a sudden, the report that was prepared would be missing.
So you'd show up at the meeting with nothing?
No report. It made me look really incompetent. And while I was able to win over the majority of the department, it definitely was a stressful 2 years. And when I look back on it now, I don't know why I really put myself through that. What point was I really trying to make or prove? And in my mind, it was like, you know, I was hired to do a job. I'm going to do the job to the best of my ability, and I'm going to leave on my own accord, and I'm not going to be just ran out. But when I look back on it, the emotional toll it took definitely was not worth it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. It was during this time of stress at work when Joyce Grandjean's recreational use of cocaine became a habit.
I can honestly say that when I was at that particular job, it really was towards the end of that 2 years that I began to sort of use on a weekly basis. I think I was addicted, although I don't really think that I thought I was. You always sort of feel like you in control. That's the denial aspect. And because I worked, I knew that I could get it if I wanted it. I had a bank account. I lived in a co-op. You know, I had access to money. So I don't really think that I was aware of how big an issue it was and how big an issue it would later be.
I mean, do you have any memory of that time when you thought to yourself, whoa, you know, I'm going through a lot of coke or I'm buying a lot of crack or whatever, any one moment that sticks in your mind?
Yeah, because I just got to be unpredictable and I have a really strong worth ethic. I've always wanted to be the best that I can be. And so calling in on a regular basis, taking off work, was not something that generally I would do. But it got where I really, even though I felt bad about it, I didn't seem to be able to control it. So I would do things like say, okay, I'm only going to get high on the weekend. That way, Monday through Friday, I'm going to go to work. I'm going to do a good job. And on the weekend is my time. That worked only for so long. It was like, oh, well, it's Thursday evening. I only got one day left. You know, you can go ahead because you can certainly make it on Friday. So you find yourself trying all different types of ways to navigate. But in the end, it doesn't work.
Because now Joyce Grandjean is struggling with racism at the office and an addiction to cocaine in her off hours. She says the turning point for her came when the director called her back to work one evening because, as it was explained to her, that same old machine was broken again.
I remember I had worked that night until about 8 p.m. I was in a sound sleep. I got a call at midnight saying the printer is not working, the schedules won't be out, you need to go back and see what's going on and get everything going. And so, of course, I get up and I go back, got the machine going, got the charts delivered, and I look and it's like 4:30, and I'm thinking to myself, it really doesn't make sense to go home only to be back in the office by 8:15. So I'm just going to stay the night. And so I slept on the floor. Well, that morning, the administrator walked into my office, and she like, oh, wow, you stayed over. And I'm like, yeah. You know, she like, well, you know, it's really good. We got things going. And I looked at her and how bright and chipper and, you know, her blouse was crisp and fresh. And she looked like she had had a good night's sleep. And here I was, hadn't brushed my teeth yet. You know, as I looked at her, it was at that moment that I decided that this was it. So I told her, you know, I'm glad everything went fine. But, you know, I was given my notice effective immediately that that was my last day.
I mean, if you think back to the time that you were supervisor there and you were doing some cocaine on a regular basis, would it be fair to say that the kind of pressure that you were under as the first black supervisor at that office may, in fact, have pushed you towards using more drugs?
I think that's a likely scenario. I was just so devastated by that experience. Growing up in Chicago, of course, I know racism exists. And I can look back on my life at certain incidences and point to where there might have been racism, but to be confronted with it on a daily basis is just something I was not prepared to handle.
Joyce Grandjean says she started experimenting with drugs in college, but seemed able to handle it as an adult. Even today, she looks back in amazement at how quickly her entire world fell apart. And I'll talk with her about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. 20 years ago, crack use was at an epidemic level. Dealers were being put in jail with mandatory minimum sentences, and hip-hop songs warned people about the dangers of crack.
He was living the life out the silver spoon. He was riding like a cowboy gone to the moon. But the pipe had him. Life's no fun. Now he's just his mama's son on a dead-end street, and he don't really know. His only family's the rocks and the blow. Crack, kill, Applejack.
Joyce Grandjean lived a pretty typical teenager's life. She tried marijuana, but she never thought those songs were really talking to her. She didn't even try harder drugs until she was in her mid-20s.
It was powder cocaine, and I was actually introduced to it as a way of staying up all night to study for exams. So it definitely was a recreational drug. Maybe once, two or three times a year, there was seven or eight of us that would get together to study all night. We'd all put our little money together and buy the drugs. And once that was over, we studied all night. Nobody even thought of it until the next time.
And so you weren't really snorting the cocaine to get high. You were doing it because you could focus on your schoolwork and get ready for exams.
Right, right. And of course, it was like a party, even though we was very focused on studying, but there was the liveliness of the group, the interaction. It was nice. It was fun at that time.
Joyce Grandjean says the person who always kept her family together was her mother. And so when her mother died, that was a time when Joyce stepped up her use of drugs.
Somebody, as a way of consoling me, brought me a pack of cocaine. And I noticed how good it made me feel. So, of course, after the services was over, I think it was the very first time that I actively sought it out on my own as a way of, this is something I want for myself. And so that probably went on for a year or better. And then I was introduced to crack cocaine. which is totally a different level.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Joyce Grandjean says that, unlike many addicts, she found she was able to continue her work. And yet, even with the money coming in, she figured her lifestyle would catch up with her.
I was having anxiety attacks. I can remember vividly one morning I got up and I was trying to get ready to go to work. And, you know, I started hyperventilating. Of course, I didn't know what hyperventilating was. The ambulance took me to the hospital and they gave me Valium. But one of the things that stick out in my mind is that they wanted to admit me to the mental ward. So I did not see the connection. I never really tried to seek out any help. I just tried to deal with whatever was going on in my life. I never went to a hospital, never seen a doctor. On the job, they knew probably what was going on. My supervisor wanted me to be seen by the employee assistance program, and I was so far gone, I made appointments to go, and it was made through our personnel office, and I never showed up. And why I didn't think that that would get back to my director is beyond me. But one day she called me into her office, and she like, "You've missed 3 appointments. You were never seen." I don't know. I remember being just so shocked and speechless when she confronted me. I really didn't have a good response for why I didn't go. So the only thing I could think of, well, I don't want anybody in my business, or I don't want people knowing.
Did your boss at the time know you were using, or were you just like kind of a mess at work and your boss wanted to get you looked at?
I don't know if she knew what the problem was. One thing for sure, she knew there was a problem. You know, so I just would come up with all of these excuses on what was going on. I always had an excuse. You find yourself trying all different types of ways to navigate. But, you know, in the end, it doesn't work. It's like Humpty Dumpty when I look back on it. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. It was like once the pieces start unraveling, no matter how hard I tried to put them back together, they never fit. So no matter what I tried, it didn't work.
Joyce Grandjean took those fragments of her life and quit her job. No 2-week notice, no phone call. Joyce simply vanished. She was on unemployment, but she lost her house for not paying rent.
I was living from my sister, my brother, my friends. And, you know, as long as you have some money, things are a little easier. There did come a time where I didn't have any income, and that was a pretty rough period. I pawned a lot of my furniture. I had fur coats. I pawned jewelry. I remember selling floor monocolored TV for drugs. Camera, quick things.
And were you selling that stuff, Joyce, and turning the money over to the dealer? Or were you just saying, look, here's a camera, give me something?
I was trading it for drugs. But oftentimes, sometime I'd like the floor model TV. I remember, you know, it was probably $800 or $900, if not more.
Yeah.
And I got $400 cash, but then I took the cash and used it for drugs. So same thing.
What about the car?
My car got repossessed for non-payment. I lost it. I had parked the car in front of the house, and I got ready to go somewhere the next day, and the car wasn't there. I thought somebody had stole it, so I called the police, and, you know, and then I thought about the fact that I was behind on my payments, and I had gotten all of these phone calls and mail. And I wasn't used to getting the phone calls from bill collectors.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things I started to do was leave the mail in the mailbox. Now, what sense that made? That's the insanity.
If I don't have to open the envelope, I don't have to pay the bill.
Right. If I don't have to open it, I don't have to deal with it. Because I felt like with all of those bills in the house, I wasn't going to be able to rest. So I left all of the mail and all of the bills, so, you know, I probably would have knew that they were going to repossess the car, but I remember that being a big shock. And I was very bitter about it because I probably owed less than $3,000 on the car, and I actually got a check for $900 back once they repoed the car and sold it.
And you should have got a lot more than that.
Yes. So, of course, you go through the anger and bitterness and being on a pity pot, but I just really was in a bad, bad way.
Did you think of suicide? Did it get that bad?
I did think of suicide, but not in the sense of like, you know, I'm going to take a knife and stab myself. It was more like I'm just going to keep using and then I'll float on off and that'll be the end of that. I'm no good to myself, family, or others. So if I can do it that way and just go. But I do remember thinking suicidal thoughts several times. But in the end, I just got tired of being sick and tired and some of the places I'd be in somebody's basement and it'd be smelly and like a group of us sitting together using, getting high. At that time, it wasn't fun anymore. And I would look around and think to myself, boy, you really have blew it now. And, you know, so I began the process of like saying to myself, you got to change. Things got to be different. I was listening to TV one day, and it said something to the effect that if cocaine had wrecked your life and using it was like putting a gun to your head, there was a number. And I had seen that commercial numerous times, but I picked up the phone and dialed the number, and I was referred to a AA meeting, and I started attending meetings, which was a major turning point in my life because it was the first time that I felt like there was hope for me.
And had you stopped the drugs at this point?
No, not at that point. When I went to the meeting, I probably was using less, but I don't think I had stopped. I stopped using at the point I started attending meetings and had a support network. It was like people would get up and say, I went through a 28-day program. I went through a 90-day program. And I was like, well, boy, if I'm staying clean by just going to meetings, I want to go to a program. And so I then contacted a women's treatment center. And every day you had to dial a number. And if you didn't call in that number and put in your ID, you was removed from the list.
This is a waiting list to get into the program, is that right?
That was a meeting list to get in.
So this was to see just how committed you were.
Yes, yes. And you never knew when you would dial that number, put your ID number in, it would say, okay, report to inpatient facility. And, of course, one day I dialed a number, and there it was at 5 a.m. report. One of the best days of my life.
You were ready for it at that time?
Yes, I was.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Joyce Grandjean says her earliest days in rehab were her hardest. Even though she's now worked her way back into a senior supervisory position, she remembers what she went through to get there.
I remember having dreams where I woke up and I thought I was using. You cannot imagine the relief I felt that it was just a dream and I wasn't back in that dark, desperate, bleak part of my life anymore. I felt immense pleasure and immense relief to know, woo, that was just a dream. I'm not really sitting in a smoke-filled room getting high. But yeah, there were moments. I had an incident when I got on the elevator and this young man opened up his hand and he had 30, 40 bags of crack cocaine and he like, come on, you want to go with me and get high? And I was just fixated on the bags in his hand. And you do get a urge. Like when I looked at it, it was like, boy. But I jumped off the elevator. Well, I got off at my floor and I went to my room and I make a joke about it. Oh, I was pacing back and forth. I'm hyper anyway. And I was pacing back and forth. And then I'm like, damn, I should have at least asked what room he was in. I don't even know who it is. Look, but it was good. I didn't know. But I remember explicitly thinking, boy, That was a lot of cocaine. We could have really had a good time, you know.
The funny thing is that our listeners don't realize at this point is that you're in charge of this housing unit that this guy was
yeah.
in. You're the boss.
That was at that time. That was many years ago, many years ago. That was the trigger. When I seen it and he had it and knowing that I could get it, even though I didn't give in to the urge, it just threw me into trying to think, who was he? Did I know him? I mean, even though I didn't act on it, it definitely, all these years later, I still remember how it made me feel.
I just wonder if you think back to those dark days when you were in those smoky basements or you were, you know, living homeless, couch surfing, that sort of thing, if you ever thought that you'd be something like a senior program manager at Cooperation for Supportive Housing. I mean, it's such a remarkable turnaround, Joyce.
I always held in the back of my mind that I wanted to be more than what I was at that particular moment. And one of the things that I held on to is, you know, you can do it because you've done it before. And that would make me feel like maybe it was possible. But when you're down, it's pretty hard to look up. And it's one of the reasons why I have such a passion for the work that I do, to inspire hope and let people know that no matter where you are in your life, things can be different, that if you can look up, you can get up. But nobody has a crystal ball, and you wouldn't know looking at me what type of help I need. So I need to be able to communicate that I need help.
How often would you just put your arm around someone and say, I think you need to hear my story, give you a little bit of confidence?
I have been at the bus stop and somebody, young lady, approached me. I constantly tell people the fact that I was homeless, the fact that I was addicted to crack cocaine. Because the thing that I hear over and over again, oh, if you didn't tell people, they'd never know. But it's really sharing your strengths and hopes with others that let them know that it's possible for them as well.
Joyce Grandjean has been clean now for nearly 16 years. She works out of Chicago at Cooperation for Supportive Housing. Special thanks to one of our listeners, Jean Butson of Evanston, Illinois, for writing in and suggesting that we speak with Joyce Grandjean. There is one loose end that Joyce helped me with here at The Story. You might recall a few weeks ago I talked with a former crack dealer. His name's Sean Hudson. And Sean was finally getting out of prison, and I asked him if he felt any remorse for the people he once sold crack to. He didn't. Here's what he said.
See, this is what people have to realize, and let me clarify this. No one puts a gun to a person's head and say, hey, I want you to smoke these drugs. The average person that gets high, snorts cocaine, or smokes crack, it's because they want to. They try the drug and they get addicted. It's no different than cigarettes.
So what's your attitude? If I don't sell it to him, somebody else will?
I wouldn't say that. My attitude is that I've done nothing to make them come to the conclusion that I'm saying, hey, you better take this drug or else.
Yeah.
My attitude is that, you know, I'm just selling the drug. I mean, I don't solicit to sell it. It sells itself.
Well, after my conversation with Sean, I got a lot of letters from people who strongly disagreed with his perspective. Tawana from Durham, North Carolina, wrote to say, as an African-American, I have to comment on the broadcast of Sean Hudson's story. He showed zero remorse for his crime or victims. I've seen firsthand the effects drug can cause a person, a family, a community, and there are thousands of innocent people that are affected by that sale. Tawana said, I have no sympathy for him with his lack of remorse. I only hope he will not influence others to follow his path or return to it himself. DJ of Raleigh, North Carolina, wrote to say that his stepson and wife lost their home, jobs, cars, and lost their child over crack. He said, the dealer uses people like doormats. He's likely to go back to his old ways, for I heard nothing of remorse, only the anger of his ego, which means he thinks people owe him. Well, when I had a chance to talk with Joyce Grandjean about her addiction to crack, I decided to ask her if she blamed the dealers, or if Sean was right to say that it wasn't his fault.
You know, I do agree with him that nobody puts a gun to your head and make you buy the drugs. Now, is it right? Well, no, it's not right. But people need jobs. They want to feed their family just like you do or I do. It was a way to make a dollar. I don't think there was ever any deep thought into I'm messing up the fabric of the community. Does it make it right? No, it doesn't make it right. Am I going to sit up here and blame the dealer for my own issues? No, I did it because I wanted to. Nobody made me do it. I wasn't kidnapped. I was the major player in my own addiction.
So if you have your own perspective on who really bears the responsibility for an addiction, or if you have a story that gives us a new way of looking at this, I'd like to hear from you. Go to our website. You can find us at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Summer's upon us, and I'm already reading stories in the newspaper about people who plan to curtail their normal holiday activities because of high gas prices. And this was on my mind when I got a note about a gang of friends from Asheville, North Carolina, who like to look for different adventures together. Ryan Steiner says they were just sitting around a few years back when someone suggested they build a raft and float down the Mississippi River. This is the stuff that many of us were weaned on, the magic adventure of Huckleberry Finn. So Ryan and Randy and Dwayne and Dave and Elliot and Gary and Lyndon built this raft, and they tested it on the family's pond.
It was 12 foot wide right. And 21 foot long. So we had rails that were 21 foot long that went underneath it that had six 55-gallon drums strapped to each rail for our pontoons. That's what made our pontoons on each side of the raft.
Now, is there anyone in the crew who's an engineer, someone who said, okay, if we're going to take seven guys on a raft, we need X number of 55-gallon drums, or how did that all work out?
It worked out because six 55-gallon drums is what fit end-to-end underneath this raft to make it 21 foot long. So, no, nobody engineered it as much as we've grown up on farm. Most of us have grown up on farms, and we said, well, this has to work. This has to be pretty close. And as we built it, we would test it out on the pond and go pushing ourselves across just to see how much weight we could carry and what kind of buoyancy we had.
What kind of grief did you guys get from people who would wander by the testing pond looking at this creation of yours?
A lot of disbelief. Very few people believed that we were going to be going on the trip, including my mom and dad, until we actually had a lot of the lumber cut and the thing was actually floating. Before that, most people would look at it and say, nah, ain't happening. There's no way you guys are doing this.
Did that weaken your resolve or strengthen it?
The more people said, no, you're not doing it, the more we said, yes, we are doing it. And we would come up with new and better ideas to make sure that it happened.
When it came time to make the trip, there'd been a lot of rain upriver, so the Mississippi was in flood. Water levels were unusually high. This crew of seven began their journey on the Arkansas River before eventually reaching the Mississippi.
We had some fishermen that came out. They were quite discouraging in a lot of ways. They were telling us how long they've been out here on the river and giving us all sorts of advice. One thing that they mentioned was snakes as big as a man's leg, which I've never seen a snake that big, and I don't plan to see a snake that big. But the eddies, they were very concerned about the eddies because of the flooding. They said that we could get into an eddy and that we could be there for a week, and they could come, that authorities could come a week later, and we would still be floating in the same spot and that we'd never get out. And we promised them that we'd be careful and went on about our adventure.
I can imagine that to put all seven guys on the raft, along with the motor and all the provisions that you were going to require, though, must have been the first time you'd had that much weight on the raft.
We'd actually driven my brother's four-wheeler out onto the raft, which weighed about 500 pounds, and we had tried to do some estimating how much weight we would actually have. But once we put everybody, their gear, our extra water, our extra food, our extra gas, the motor, once everything was on, we realized how heavy we actually were and quickly found out that because of all the supplies and the motor in the back, we had to be very careful that not all seven could go to the back. We had to keep people up front because if everyone went to the back, it would actually submerge and go under about 6 inches. So we quickly realized that we had to do a little planning. You had to be a little careful. You got your gear back there. You don't want that going underwater.
Do you remember seeing the Mississippi for the first time?
Yes, very much so. It was a long, hard push just to get there. And when we finally came around that last corner, we saw ahead of us, we came from about a half-mile wide river, and ahead of us we saw a river that was approximately 2.5 miles wide. We were seeing whole trees, including roots, floating by at a what it looked like to us a very, very rapid pace. We were having to navigate trees that were actually turning, making the turn and coming up the, at that point would have been the White River. So it was a lot of things going on right then with the motor running, having to push, and then seeing all this debris, these logs, these trees, these parts of houses. You could see parts of houses floating by, and that was a frightening time. We had our life jackets normally tied up, and at that point we pulled life jackets down and had them ready just in case, just didn't know. It was a lot of uncertainties right there.
And what did you figure, Ryan, that you'd be safer in the middle of the river or close to one bank? What was the plan?
Well, when we were doing our planning, we figured that we would have to stay away from the banks because they actually build walls out there into the river to keep it from eroding, because it's constantly eroding. There's a lot of sand moving all the time on the river, on the Mississippi. And we figured that we would probably have to be staying somewhere towards the middle, but because of the floodwaters, we were able to pretty much stick to the shores, right up against the shores. So when we first got onto the river, we pretty much pushed straight out fairly close to the middle, other than staying out of the way of barges. We hadn't seen any yet, but we knew that where the channel was according to our maps, and we wanted to stay out of that way and make sure that we didn't get out in their way, the first thing we did. But it didn't take us very long at all to quickly realize that, you know, as long as we keep our eyes open, we'll be fine just to float right very close to shore, within a couple hundred yards of shore.
And talk to me a little bit about the current of the river, because I know from being in canoes and kayaks that a river always looks more frightening when it's going past you. And once you're in the current, it's not quite so intimidating. I mean, did you have that same sense of just getting caught up in it?
The instant we got into the current and hit the current and were able to navigate out into it just a little bit, we killed the motor. And that was quite a sense of relaxation, I guess you could say, just being able to float along. And the trees, instead of going past you at a rapid clip, are now moving the same speed you are, floating along, very little noise, other than a little bit of swirling water occasionally from a few small eddies. But we were far enough from shore, you really didn't hear that much human noise, any traffic noise, anything other than a slight bit of swirling water. And we did a lot of oohing and aahing, looking at the shore and realizing how fast the shore was going by. And I think there was moments there in that first few minutes that we wondered, you know, is this trip going to be over in 2 days rather than 4 days because of how fast we were going.
I want to read you something from The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. I was looking at my copy last night trying to imagine you guys out on the raft, and Mark Twain writes, "It was kind of solemn drifting down the big still river, laying on our backs looking up at the stars, and we didn't even feel like talking out loud, and it weren't often that we laughed, only a kind of low chuckle. We had mighty good weather as a general thing, and nothing ever happened to us at all that night, nor the next, nor the next." And just as I was listening to you describe that sense of being out in the current and looking around and saying, "Whoa, we're here," was there any of that feeling among you and the seven guys on the raft? Like, did it make you a little quieter, a little more like sitting there and looking around and just watching it all go by?
I think we all just kind of kicked back, pulled the life jackets back off, relaxed a little, and a lot of us said wow many times, just sitting there and watching things go by, just in awe of what was going on. And I can remember many times several of us saying that, "Can you believe this? We're on the Mississippi River on a raft."
It is. It's like the classic American experience. You know?
Yes, that was discussed many times. Think of how many people would die to be able to do what we're doing today in a hand-built raft. We've got good food. We've got plenty of drinking water. We're just out here relaxing. We haven't seen any other people, haven't seen any other barges, haven't seen really any sign of life. There was a lot of talk about that, how neat of an experience we're experiencing right now.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Well, eventually they did see barges. They even heard one sound the danger alert, and they watched as the crew scurried on deck and dropped the life rafts. Ryan and the gang soon realized that it was just a drill. But those Mississippi River barges were much larger than what they'd expected.
If they're empty, they sit about 10 feet out of the water. If they're loaded, they're down within, the deck is within about 4 feet of the water. And these things are 100 feet wide and 200 feet long.
Wow.
And not only is there just one of these barges, the most we saw was 49 of these barges moored, seven wide and seven long, with one tug pushing upriver. So a very large floating platform. Not only is this one barge large, but it's a large floating platform when these all are moored together and pushing upstream.
Yeah, what kind of a wake does it kick out?
We saw as high as about 8 feet on the wake that they were pushing to the side, but the big wake came right behind the tug because of it pushing so hard to go upstream. We saw as high as about 12 feet high,
but
and that was our guesstimation.
That'd swamp your raft.
Very much so. When we're 12 feet wide, and these wakes are 12 feet tall, we're talking about us being completely sideways in one of these and hardly being able to see us.
How did you avoid getting swamped? What did you do?
Stayed away from them, which actually isn't very hard. There was no place that we encountered that was less than about a mile and a half wide. So it really wasn't that hard to stay away from them.
So if you're half a mile away from one of these barges, then that 12-foot wake or the 8-foot wake is considerably reduced by the time it gets to you. That's the point?
Yes. The biggest wake we went through was probably about 4 foot high, which did a lot of vibration. We just made sure that things were not close to the edge and hang on, everybody hang on.
And did you guys continue drifting at night or did you tie up?
The very first night that we were on the Mississippi, which would have been the second night of the trip, we had very detailed maps that showed us where all the sandbars, where the islands, where there's trees, where there's sand, showed us all the information, where we need to be, what mile marker we're at. And the very first night, we actually tied up to an island, the very top of an island. We were seeing about 15 feet of trees stick out of the water, and we tied up to the tops of these trees where it was supposed to be about an acre in size island, but because of the high waters, we were basically just floating over top. But the one night, we did float all night. We tried to keep usually two watchmen awake every hour. We would change every 2 hours, and we had enough guys that we were able to pretty much keep the whole night that way. And I was the odd man out. I was the one that was awake by myself. I took the first watch, and what we didn't realize when we decided to float that night is that there was going to be a full lunar eclipse. And about 11 o'clock that evening, about halfway through my watch, we were able to witness a full lunar eclipse that evening.
Now, that means everything goes completely dark, right?
Everything completely dark. There's still a little bit of light just from the reflection, but the moon itself was completely black.
Did you guys have signal lantern out some way so people would know you were there?
As long as there was nobody around that we could see, which you can see several miles in either direction typically, we would turn the lights off to conserve battery power. But as soon as we'd see a barge coming, then we would flip the lights on.
How did the other boats react to you?
Most times in very positive ways. Occasionally we'd have someone that would try to figure us out. Because of us floating, we would often be slowly circling, and so they were not able to figure out what we were actually doing because they'd see red on the front and the light in the back, and they'd see green on the front and the light on the other side. So there was a lot of, I think, mixed reactions trying to figure out, what are these guys doing? And the barges have very large spotlights that they use to navigate the river that they can see their buoys and that they can use to navigate, see their mile markers and whatnot at night. And they would often use them, while it's illegal to shine directly on another craft, they would use them to illuminate us from a distance to try to figure out, what is this?
If you'll bear with me, I'll read you one more line from Huck Finn, because this is one that stuck in my head when I was thinking of your trip. This is Huck and Jim talking about their time on the raft. We said there weren't no home like a raft after all. Other places do seem so cramped up and smothery, but a raft don't. You feel mighty free and easy and comfortable on a raft. Did he have it right?
Yes and no. You feel mighty free and easy, but you're talking about two people on their raft compared to seven on ours.
Seven guys on a raft that's 12 feet wide and 21 feet long for, 4 days, right?
Yes.
Was there ever a time when you felt a little bit hemmed in by the size of the craft that you were on?
By day three, I think everybody was getting close to being ready to get off, just to get away from everybody else. While we thoroughly enjoyed the trip, it was starting to get old, just being that close, really not able to get off the raft other than if you went for a swim and go out and ride on a log for a while. Really, that's the only way to get away from the other six guys. So by day three, we were pretty much getting fed up.
So as much as you were looking forward to the trip and as much as you enjoyed it, you were happy when it came to an end.
Yes, very much so. We were ready to get off the river, have showers, and we were just ready to get back on the road and get back home.
You ever sat around since that trip and talked about what it was you got out of rafting on the Mississippi?
There's so many memories, so many times that I kick back and start thinking about what I did and how much fun that I've had, and drive over the Mississippi River, go over, cross it on a bridge, and look down and say, I was in that river. I floated that river. I did that. The Mississippi River is part of our American culture, American heritage. With the Mississippi, there's just that thing of people look at it and say, the Mississippi, you floated the Mississippi.
Yeah, they'd know what you were talking about if you told them that at a cafe in Paris or at a coffee shop in Tibet. It has that much of a reputation.
Yes.
Myself a raft of wood, I would float it whenever I could, till the day it sank right in into the river like Hawk Finn.
Ryan Steiner and his crew all made it safely home. If you have your own story of living out a little piece of American or an adventure like that, let me know. Speaking of classic little pieces of America, tomorrow on The Story I'll talk with the singer Kathy Mattea. She was better known in years past for chart-topping country songs like 18 Wheels and a Dozen Roses, but Kathy's new album, Coal, takes her in a new direction. It's a personal exploration of her West Virginia mountain heritage and her family's coal mining past. But as she tells me, returning to your roots isn't always easy.
What I was afraid of was that I would come to this music and I wouldn't be able to strip enough of the affect from singing commercial music for 20 years to be able to connect with these songs in a raw enough way to bring them forth. And I knew that if I couldn't do that, I'd sound like a lounge singer, you know? It would be awful. Or like a, you know, somebody with a classically trained voice trying to sing country music. It just doesn't work. And so I didn't know. And it took me a while. I mean, I had to work hard at getting out of the way, getting my own ego and my own self out of the way, and to just try to open my mouth and let the song come through me.
He's had more hard luck than most men could stand. The mines was his first love, but never his friend. He's lived a hard life, and hard he'll die. Black lungs done got him, his time is nigh. Black lung, oh, you're just biding your time. Soon all of this suffering I'll leave behind. But I can't help but wonder what God had in mind to send such a devil to claim this soul of mine. He went to the boss man.
The singer Kathy Mattea is my guest tomorrow on The Story. She'll be here along with her new coal mining songs. And if you have suggestions of stories, singers, adventures that you want to talk about, perhaps even the suggestion of a guest who might be too bashful to talk about himself or herself, well, get in touch with me. Go to our website at thestory.org or leave me a short message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.